end of his last climax of the night, but later he suggested to Janice that the girl would have received the knife with a smile if he had wished to go that far and pay the charge required to dispose of her remains and install another girl in her quarters. The revolution must be won, and Janice is determined to be one of those at the apex of this techno-utopia, for otherwise, there is no refuge for her in this world, no safety, no surcease from fear. The freckle-faced bitch stands beside her, not immediately responsive to Janice's introduction. With the hand that is behind the girl, Janice twists Lori's belt, pinching her waist as a reminder that the little whore's position is precarious. She repeats, "Lori Longgren wants to apologize. She called you out here because she misunderstood the situation." The deceitful slut clears her throat, smiles, and waves at the crowd, which Janice thinks is a clever touch, a convincing gesture. "This nice lady," says Lori Longgren, raising her voice to compete with the chopper, but letting no quiver of fear taint her words. "This nice lady would like you to leave, and if you leave, she'll kill me." The stupid bitch has no common sense, no survival instinct. With her last three words, she tries to pull away, but she can't wrench free of her captor's grip. Janice draws the pistol, jams the muzzle against the girl's temple. The crowd reacts, and some of them start forward. "Her death's on you!" Janice shouts. "One more step and I'll blow her brains out! I chambered around before I came out here. I've got some pull on the trigger. It's a hair away from discharge. Her brains'll be all over your stupid faces." What now? What now? No refuge, no safety, no surcease from fear. Rejection, submission, enslavement, endless degradation. No pleasure left, except to kill the hateful little shit. Chapter 24. Chris and Sally and the six from Austin ease back from their confrontational stance, separating themselves from the mob as well as from Janice Dern. Too many guns, too much emotion. No way this can end in a truce. Every action that Chris and his crew take from now on must be calculated to reduce the number of casualties on their side. This is not his familiar partner, not the Janice with whom he's worked for more than 2 years. There has been a dangerous fault line in her, some San Andreas of the mind, waiting for the right kind of stress to quake her. You think that you know a colleague's mind and heart, know her far better than your sister, but maybe no one ever really knows the truth of anyone. The helicopter's searchlight evidently can be powered higher with the twist of a switch, because abruptly, the beam doubles in brightness as it narrows in diameter, leaving a portion of the veranda in soft shadow, even as it focuses on Janice and Lori with such blazing intensity that it seems capable of setting them aflame. And the moths, a dance within it, flicker like sparks rising from some infernal fire under the earth. The girl shields her eyes with one hand, and Janice shouts at the chopper pilot, who of course can't hear her. The young Austin agent beside Chris says, "The crazy bastard wants to save her, but he'll get her killed instead." It's one of those occasions when death plays games with the living, just to impress upon them that no one is immune from the touch of his fleshless fingers, not even freckled little girls. Infuriated, driven by emotion rather than reason, with a one-hand grip, Janice takes an unlikely distant shot at the chopper. The double crack of two guns echo together through the night, which is when Chris Roberts realizes the co-pilot at the open door must also be a well-trained sniper, perhaps former military. No one is immune, not even freckled little girls, or those who would kill them. Before Janice can bring the muzzle of the pistol back to the hostage's head, she receives a bullet of her own, a round of such high caliber and velocity that her skull comes apart like a hollow pumpkin in which Halloween pranksters have put a few cherry bombs, swatches of her hair in flight like strange, wet birds born out of some grim dream. Janice collapses as she's flung backward, and the screaming girl bolts down the steps into the yard, flailing her hands in her hair as if to chase off a swarm of bees, screaming to her knees, and thereafter, sobbing. Chapter 25. At 4:10 a.m., in the bedroom of his suite in the Hyatt Regency Hotel, Egon Gottfried is awakened by the ringtone of his smartphone. The script requires him to be at once alert, and he sits up in bed, wide awake after less than 4 hours of sleep. From his immediate Arcadian superior, he receives a report of the events at Longren Stables. Janice Dern dead, following a psychotic episode, a tense standoff that could have led to additional deaths but did not, a negotiated exit by all the agents involved, whereby they do not acknowledge wrongdoing of any kind, an agreement by the mob of vigilantes not to question the validity of the agent's FBI credentials as long as they depart at once and permanently, an understanding that there will be no prosecution of the sniper or vengeance of any kind against him, and adequate steps being taken by private sector Arcadians to prevent internet distribution of any vigilante account of these events or photographs of the agents involved. Considering the unknown playwright's usual style and narrative tendencies, this is surely not the way he intended this scene to be performed. Consequently, based on past experience, Gottfried assumes that characters who were supposed to be administrators of pain will find themselves recipients of it, so that they might learn to intuit the intentions of the author more accurately. Evidently, the playwright has given up entirely on the learning ability of the Janice Dern character. However, Gottfried finds it difficult to believe that he himself will be blamed and made to suffer for this deviation from the script when he wasn't even present for the action. He has been harried from Worsted to Killeen to Houston and has neither failed to follow the leads given him nor complained about the demands that the story has put upon him. Go with the flow. Nothing is real anyway. Subsequent to the report of the debacle at Longren Stables, the caller reveals that agents have been following up on the many buses that departed the Houston terminal during the period when Ansel and Claire Hawk might have been stowaways, and that one of them has struck pay dirt. There is video of the fugitives disembarking from a bus that departed Houston at 3:30 p.m. the previous day and arrived in Beaumont less than 2 hours later at 5:02. An Uber driver in Beaumont has additional information that will assist in the search. From your current location, the caller says, the drive to Beaumont will take approximately 1 hour and 27 minutes if you depart prior to morning traffic. We'll be there before 7 o'clock, Gottfried says. The MedExpress carrier containing the control mechanisms should maintain an appropriate temperature for at least another 36 hours. The carrier is on the nightstand. Gottfried reports the number on the digital readout. 42 degrees. Good. Now the clothes you were wearing yesterday have been cleaned and pressed. They'll be sent up to you by a bellman when you call the front desk. Another conflicting detail, Gottfried says. Excuse me? The hotel's own directory of services doesn't offer 4-hour laundry and dry cleaning, certainly not late night. Yes, but of course we made special arrangements. A minor rewrite. A what? They say it's good to be the king, Gottfried replies. But the real power is with the author of the play, who can change details, rewrite anything he wants, and make it turn out different. I hadn't thought of it that way, the caller says. We're rewriting the play, and the play is this country, the world, the future. Well, Gottfried says, throwing back the bedclothes, the script calls for me to take a shower. The caller laughs. Make it a short one and hit the road. We need to get the in-laws, brain shag 'em, and find the damn kid. We break Jane's heart, we'll also break the bitch's will. Chapter 26. The same night, the same Texas plain, infinite in appearance, the same sky overhead, infinite in fact, the same radically hot, bespoke Range Rover by Overfinch North America. Yet all is different. Chris Roberts marvels at how everything can change so profoundly in 1 hour. When he was cruising back and forth on this same highway, looking for the runaway Lundgren girl, he'd been thinking about shacking up with Janice for a torrid week, picturing her naked, figuring that even at just 35 he might need a bottle of Viagra to keep up with her. Now, her body and the jigsaw puzzle that is her head are wrapped in a waterproof tarp provided by Lundgren Stables, the ends folded and secured with almost an entire roll of strapping tape, resting in the cargo area behind the back seat. Picturing her naked is neither as easy nor as appealing as it was an hour earlier. This is a sobering journey, even for Chris, who is neither a pessimist nor a deep thinker. Pessimism is a waste of time, because you can't forestall disaster by sitting around and brooding about it. Anyway, you can't be a pessimist and also a fun guy. Chris thinks of himself as a major fun guy. As for deep thinkers, well, the deep thinkers he's known mostly become alcoholics, and if they don't become alcoholics, they kill themselves. The few that have neither killed themselves nor become alcoholics are either in mental institutions or ought to be. Nevertheless, cruising now through the last hours of the night on a 4-hour drive to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, Chris has what he believes to be a deep thought. It scares him a little, not just the fact that it's deep, but the thought itself. Because he's the kind of guy who can get people to talk about themselves, he's aware that a significant percentage of the techno-Arcadians he knows have come from dysfunctional families. Janice has said little about her folks, except that she not only renounced her parents and sisters and hadn't seen them in 14 years, but also wished they would all die of a painful, disfiguring disease. Now, in light of what happened at the Lundgren place, Chris wonders if the fact that so many Arcadians come from dysfunctional families might result in the entire techno-Arcadian project becoming dysfunctional in the long run. Fortunately, he doesn't come from a dysfunctional family, and perhaps this gives him a competitive advantage within the ranks of the revolution. His mother and father love each other and never argue. They ran a prosperous business together, and 5 years ago, at the age of just 58, they retired to an ocean view home in Laguna Beach. They shower him with affection, always have, and he has only excellent memories of his childhood, especially when he reached puberty, whereupon many of the girls in his mom and dad's high-end, super-discreet Westside L.A. escort service thought he was a cute kid, a little blonde Tom Cruise, and wanted to please his mother by doing him for free. Nostalgic reveries aren't enough to take his mind off Janice back there in the cargo area. Each time he hits a bump in the road or takes a sharp turn, the tarp slides around a little, and he imagines, hopes he only imagines, that he hears her making sounds within the shroud. He has a long drive ahead of him before he can deliver Janice to the owner of a construction company, a fellow techno-Arcadian who builds entire communities in the outlying suburbs of Fort Worth, and who will find a nice resting place for her under the concrete slab foundation of one structure or another. They can't very well blame her death on Jane Hawk, considering how many people know otherwise, and in the interest of putting the entire Lundgren Stables operation behind them as though it never happened, it is best that Janice just disappear. Her name will be purged from the FBI, Homeland, and NSA personnel records. Her pensions have not had time to vest, so they can just evaporate. And because her family, whether slowly dying of a disfiguring disease or healthy, have for 14 years not known her whereabouts, no relative is going to come looking for her. That someone as young and hot as Janice should end this way is sad. Really sad. Epic sad. And Chris Roberts doesn't like to be sad. Sad is not who he is. He's a fun guy, and he's driving a radically hot vehicle, and he needs some bitchin' music to chase away the sadness. Puff Daddy is the right stuff most of the time, but that music doesn't feel right for driving dead Janice to an unmarked grave. He thinks about it for a couple miles, and then he pops some TLC into the system. Baby, Baby, Baby starts to improve his mood, and Red Light Special, and then... Wham! Digging on you, hoses away sadness. This was the true Wood back in the day. He was into it even before puberty, cool with the music, sexually precocious, ready for the future yesterday. Tian Watkins, Lisa Lopez, Rosanda Thomas, hot, hot, hot. And now their big hit, No Scrubs, totally top of the charts. The music gets him up and keeps him up as he races through the pre-dawn Texas dark toward a future that is Arcadian, that is inevitable, that belongs to him. Chapter 27. No matter how much shampoo she used or how long she stood under the hot water, Lori Longren didn't feel clean. Although the water was so stinging hot that she turned a boiled pink color head to foot, she couldn't melt away the chill in her chest, couldn't stop shivering. Her mother waited with a bath towel when Lori at last stepped out of the shower stall. Lori preferred to dry herself. She'd been drying herself for ages and ages. However, she understood that her mother didn't merely want to do it, but also needed to do it, as if reassuring herself that her oldest daughter was alive and unharmed. So Lori allowed it. Mother kept telling her, promising her, nothing like this would happen again. They were taking steps to defend themselves against the repetition of such a horror. Every adult on their property would henceforth be armed at all times, from now until Jane Hawk was able to produce evidence to expose these power-mad bastards and clear her name. Lori and her sisters would be homeschooled, where no one could try to get at them. Lori's mom didn't get weepy at every sad movie, didn't get emotional over every little thing, and there were no tears in her eyes now. She was angry, furious, incensed at the people who had invaded her home. At the same time, she was tender and loving. Also, at the same time, she was worried and scared and trying hard to hide those feelings. Even as rattled as Lori was, she could recognize all these emotions in her mother because her mom and dad were the two people in the world she most trusted and admired. She was always watching them when they didn't realize it, not watching them from a hiding place or anything creepy like that, just studying them to figure out how they were who they were. By watching them, she'd learned who she wanted to be and how to become that person. Though she wasn't that person yet, there was a long road ahead. Mother didn't lie, but she couldn't guarantee that what had happened wouldn't happen again. She and Daddy were people who got things done, didn't take crap, and were confident without being arrogant. What Mother meant was that she would die to stop people coming down on her family the way the thugs had done this time. Lori put on pajamas and sat on a vanity bench while her mother brushed and blew dry her hair, and she let herself be tucked in bed because she realized her mother needed to do it. It was also true that Lori needed to have it done, to have the covers smoothed around her and to be kissed on the brow, the cheek. But when Mother wanted to sit bedside to watch over her as she slept, Lori said, "I love you. Really need you. Always will. But Daphne and Artemis are just little kids. They need you even more." Her mother bent over her and felt her brow, as if Lori might have a fever. "You're going to be all right." Those words had not been in the form of a question, but Lori knew that's what they were.
"Yeah, sure. I'll be all right. I've got you and Daddy and Daphne and Artemis and all the horses. I'd be a totally stupid dink if I wasn't going to be all right."
After Mother left, Daddy came to her and sat on the edge of the bed. "I'm so sorry, sweetheart. God, I'm so sorry. But you were amazing what you did." He'd been set upon by a band of vicious goons with guns, maybe FBI, maybe not, but with real-looking FBI badges, and there was nothing he could have done differently and still be law-abiding. Yet he blamed himself for underestimating how wicked even real FBI guys might be if they also were bad hats. He hated having let them get the upper hand to the point that they could do what they wanted, even tie him up. He was a tough guy. She had no doubt her father was a tough guy. but he was also a good guy, and sometimes bad people had an advantage over good guys just because they were good. She sat up in bed and put her arms around him and hugged him hard, even though she was as tired as if she'd been walking all night through a hurricane, hugged him harder than she'd ever hugged him before. He hadn't needed to say anything, and she didn't need to say anything now, because they loved each other and knew the truth of each other. And besides, being Texans, they didn't indulge in a lot of useless palaver. Daddy used a dimmer switch to turn her lamp low, but he didn't switch it off. He could have switched it off. She would have been okay in the dark. She wasn't afraid of the dark. No one should be afraid of the dark. It was the wrong kind of people who might kill you, not the dark. But she was glad that he left the lamp on, because when he turned at the door and looked back at her, she could see him better. She liked the way he looked, strong and tough, but so very kind. He could see her better, too, so he could see her smile. Lori figured he needed to see her smile. When he closed the door behind him, she closed her eyes. In Lori's interior darkness, Janice loomed vividly, face distorted and strange, eyes yellow with an infall of attic light, her whisper as vicious as her poisonous stare. "My little pet." Lori opened her eyes. She had never been so weary, tired in mind and heart and flesh and bone, but she couldn't stop thinking. Jane Hawk's mother had supposedly killed herself when Jane was a little girl. Her father was a famous pianist, performing all over the world. He'd been on a TV show Sunday evening, saying his only child was mentally ill or some such horse shit. Lori's parents didn't know, but she'd once overheard them talking about Martin Duroc, how his first wife hadn't really committed suicide, that he had killed her and gotten away with it, how even as a child Jane knew, heard him or something, but had no proof, which was freaky. Janice and Jane. How could they both come from basket case families and turn out so different? One a vicious outlaw, the other doing everything she could to crush the bad hats. Lori and her best friend, Bonnie Jean Haney, both came from good families, so probably they would both turn out good. But was it possible? Like Janice and Jane, one would turn out to be a psycho bitch and the other a hero marine or something? And what about Daphne and Artemis, her sisters? Would maybe one of them grow up to rob banks and blow up churches? If who you were raised to be and who you most wanted to become didn't matter, if you could become some monster instead, that was a scary thing to consider. If Janice came from a rotten family and didn't want to be a dirtbag herself, but became rotten anyway, that was sad. Whether it was sad or not, however, Janice was dead, and that was good. If Lori was confused about other things right now, she was not confused about the rightness of Janice being dead. Janice alive? Not good. Janice dead? Hallelujah. In spite of being raised right, in spite of wanting to be good, if one day Lori Longren became a raging monster, she would want someone to kill her. Finally, she closed her eyes. She slept. In one of her dreams, Lori was all grown up, a rotten, crazy bitch, and Janice Dern was an innocent little girl who said horseshit too much. They were on the veranda together, trying to encourage the firemen and firewomen to go away so that Lori could kill little Janice. The sniper in the helicopter shot Lori, and her head exploded. She kept trying to pick up the pieces and put her head back together, but there was a big chunk of her skull missing and a lot of her brain, and one of her eyes had rolled where she couldn't find it. She was frantically trying to make herself whole again, desperate to live, even though she was a monster. And she kept saying, "I didn't mean it. I was lying. That was all horse shit. I don't want to be killed." When she woke, she wasn't screaming, but she was crying hard. She couldn't stop crying. She buried her face in a pillow to muffle her sobs so that no one would hear. She cried as though to use a lifetime of tears in this single, terrible sadness. And one thing that kept her crying was the new understanding that there was no using up of all tears, that tears would be as much a part of her life for the rest of her life as would be laughter and hope. Part 3. Reptiles. Chapter 1. Borrego Valley at dawn. Fleecy clouds blazing bright coral against a turquoise eastern sky, paling slowly to blue. Carter Jurgen and Radley DuBose are cruising around, looking for stains on the fabric of normalcy, which might turn out to be indications, signs, manifestations, simply put, clues to the whereabouts of Travis Hawke. More accurately, DuBose is thus engaged, while in the front passenger seat, Jurgen takes note of a seemingly endless series of things about the desert that disturb him. Three ungainly vultures describe a narrowing gyre in the dry air above the golf course at the Borrego Springs Resort, perhaps eyeing the pathetic cadaver of an early golfer who has dropped dead of heatstroke on the third green. Who would want to play golf in a desert? Jurgen wonders.
Lots of people, DuBose says. It's pleasant to play in such low humidity.
Well, you're never going to find me whacking a golf ball around in 110-degree heat.
I would never look for you there, my friend. I would assume your leisure time is full up with polo, croquet, and fox hunts.
Another dig at Jurgen's Boston Brahmin roots. The remark has no effect. By now, he's immune to such ridicule.
Anyway, DuBose continues, it doesn't get 110 for at least another month. Predicted high for today is 92.
Jurgen says, positively frigid. Ahead, another denizen of the desert is crossing the highway, a 6-foot rattlesnake. In awareness of the velociraptor, the serpent raises the first 3 feet of its length off the pavement and turns its head toward them with eerie fluidity. DuBose purposely aims for the viper. The truck hits it at 50 miles an hour, and for a minute or so, the entangled creature slaps noisily against the undercarriage like a length of cable snared around an axle. When quiet returns, Jurgen says, "What if you didn't kill it? If we get out and it's alive under there somewhere, it's going to be pissed. They aren't that easy to kill."
"My friend, I think you're confusing rattlesnakes with the hard-boiled, hard-bitten, intractable Boston debutantes you remember from your youth."
Jurgen is spared the need to engage in witless tit-for-tat when DuBose's smartphone rings. It's on the seat, between his thighs, and the pride of West Virginia rubs it against his crotch, as though for luck, before taking the call. Tarantulas, vultures, intolerable heat, rattlesnakes, and now the most disturbing thing yet, a 30-year-old rust bucket Dodge pickup broken down at the side of the road and standing next to it, one of those lifelong desert dwellers, a sun-baked, sun-withered old woman in red athletic shoes and cargo pocket khakis and tan linen shirt and straw hat with snow-white tangles of hair and a wrinkled face reminiscent of the pinched countenance of a desert tortoise. She vigorously waves a handkerchief to signal a need for assistance. After at least 8 decades in the Anza Borrego, she's most likely a half-crazed package of bad attitude, stubbornness, and crackpot opinions that she'll insist on sharing ad nauseam. In such circumstances, not reliably but occasionally, Radley DuBose experiences a welling up of down-home neighborliness and backwoods charm, which most of the time exists in him only to the extent that water exists in a stone. He is then capable of spending an hour to help a lost 3-legged dog cross a busy street, take it to the address on its collar, and chat with the grateful owner. With the phone to one ear, muttering solemn 1- and 2-word responses to whatever the caller is telling him, DuBose, fortunately, is not in a she-reminds-me-of-my-granny mood. He increases speed as they approach the disabled pickup, although as they flash past the old woman, he toots the horn twice, as if to say that he's rooting for her not to end up as a vulture's dinner. When the big man terminates the call and returns the smartphone to his crotch, his eyes remain unreadable behind the lenses of his sunglasses,
but otherwise, his expression is somber.
Here it is, party time, and someone pissed in the punch bowl.
Durgan supposes that must be a Princeton expression. Give me a translation.
We got a really bad crocodile incident over at the Corrigan place.
Crocodiles are tropical, not desert reptiles, Durgan says.
It's not that kind of crocodile. It's the kind Bertold Schenck worried about.
Schenck was the scientist who developed the nanomachine brain implants. With the assistance of several financial backers of his research, he also evolved the strategy and tactics for imposing the Arcadian utopia on a troubled, disordered world.
DuBose says, "You'll see, soon enough, when we get to Rooney Corrigan's place."
"Who's he?" Durgan asks.
"Third generation Borrego Valley. Knows a lot of people around here. Who's who, what's what. He's ideal for the search party."
Sand sucker high society.
"He, his wife, two sons, all were brain screwed last night."
The approved term is adjusted. They were adjusted last night, and they're now adjusted people. DuBose makes a dismissive sound between a sigh and a snort.
"I say potato, you say potato."
Chapter 2. Cornell woke early. On the iPod, Mr. Paul Simon was softly singing an ultra-infectious song. "Some people say a lie's a lie's a lie, but I say why? Why deny the obvious, child? Why deny the obvious, child?" When Cornell had awakened hours earlier, he'd been scared and needed music. The iPod was programmed with different playlists of Mr. Paul Simon's songs that he found suitable for the dead of night. The boy was still snoozing on the other big sofa. Both dogs were curled up there with him, and right now they didn't look like they had ever bitten anyone or ever would. Cornell went into the bathroom, where he stopped just inside the door, abruptly in the grip of dread, though he didn't know why. Oh, yes, the toothbrush. But the toothbrush wasn't here now, and the boy hadn't meant to terrorize him. It wouldn't happen again. Cornell brushed his teeth without fear, showered, dressed for the day, and returned to the sofas. The boy still slept, but the dogs were alert. Mr. Paul Simon was singing, "Losing love is like a window in your heart. Everybody sees you're blown apart." The German shepherds got off the sofa without disturbing the boy. They were very considerate dogs. Cornell fed them kibble and took them out to toilet. While he stood waiting, he heard an airplane. It was louder than usual for air traffic in this remote valley. He searched the sky. When he found the plane, it was passing over at less than 2,000 feet, heading south. The dogs peed first, but then they wandered around, sniffing the ground, sniffing the weeds, and took their time deciding whether and where to poop. Just as the dogs finished their business, the sound of the airplane, which had faded, grew louder once more. Duke and Queenie scampered over toward the little blue house, not running away, just playing with each other. Cornell watched the sky, and this time the plane appeared on a northward course. He was pretty sure this was the same aircraft, and that it was a twin-engine model, not a light single-engine Piper or the like that came and went from the Anza Airpark. After all these years of living with himself, Cornell Jasperson still didn't know why he was the way he was. He probably never would understand himself, because each time he seemed on an even keel, his day shaped by routines and rituals that kept him nicely balanced and content, something that never disturbed him before suddenly caused him great anxiety, like a toothbrush or this airplane. Previously, the sounds made by airplanes or by trucks, cars, motorcycles, machinery had not once concerned him. But for some reason, this plane now threw off a sound that he felt as well as heard, that crawled on his skin like thousands of ants, spiraled up his nostrils, squirmed in his ears, prickled across his eyes on tens of thousands of invisible ant legs. For years, Cornell had worn dreadlocks,
Just 10 days earlier, he'd learned that Mr. Bob Marley, the reggae star, had been dead for decades. So then he began waking up at night and thinking about Mr. Bob Marley in a coffin. He felt as if he was wearing a dead man's hair. Although he never liked reggae, Cornell became so disturbed that he shaved his head as smooth as a misshapen egg. The dreadlocks incident was a minor disturbance compared to his reaction to the airplane. The noise again slowly faded, this time as the craft flew north, but its effect on Cornell didn't diminish with its volume. Invisible ants were crawling over him and all through his insides, even through the chambers of his heart. The sound was touching him in the invasive, demanding way that people touched him, and he knew the airplane was going to drain his mind and soul from him, so that he would not be anybody anymore, just a thing without memories and purpose. He shouted at the dogs, calling them to him. He turned from them and hunched his dinosaur shoulder blades and ducked his head and ran in his shambling fashion toward the barn that was a secret library, surprised at how far he had moved away from it. The electronic key in a pocket of his jeans signaled the lock to disengage. He stumbled into the vestibule. The dogs exploded into it behind him, excited by his anxiety, or maybe thinking he wanted to play, panting and whining with what sounded like delight, tongues lolling, claws clicking on the floor, spanking each other with their tails, dancing around in the small space, thumping against the walls. The door fell shut behind them. From this side, the inner door of the vestibule would open only to Cornell's touch. In his fright, he reached for the lever-style handle and thought of the boy inside, and stayed his hand, and stood trembling, confused, torn between an urgent need for the refuge of the library and a desire not to alarm the child. A crawly feeling, head to foot, blood flukes swimming through his veins and arteries and nibbling at his heart from within its auricles and ventricles, spiders swarming across the walls of his stomach, centipedes squirming into his bones to lay eggs in his marrow. Pestilence in great variety infested him, consuming his soul and mind in millions of microscopic bites. The airplane had passed to the north, and although a little of the engine noise might still be scratching at the morning beyond the outer door, none penetrated to the vestibule. However, the absence of the offending sound didn't at once relieve his reaction to it. Sometimes, after such an episode, he was distraught for hours, needed to lie down in the quiet dark to imagine that he floated in a cooling pool of water. But he couldn't turn off the light in the vestibule and stand here for hours until the heebie-jeebies passed. The boy might wake and wonder where he had gone. Cornell was responsible for the boy until his mother came for him, until his mother came, until his mother came. Besides, even if the foyer was entirely dark, the dogs would not be perfectly quiet. And while he was standing instead of lying down, he couldn't easily pretend that he was floating in a soothing pool of water.
"Cornell," said Cornell aloud, impatient with himself, "you can do this thing here. You can calm yourself and be responsible about the little boy. You're responsible about designing good apps that make millions of people happy, and you're responsible with managing your scary amount of money, keeping it safe and making it grow, so you can be responsible about the boy."
Of course, he never saw the millions who used his apps, and he communicated with his bankers and investment advisors only by phone and email. There was no chance that they would have an opportunity to touch him. But the boy might do that, even though he knew that he shouldn't. Might touch Cornell by accident. The dogs whined, wondering why they were delayed here. Cornell thought, "The boy is going to be at risk because of me. The boy is going to die because of me." Horrified, he said,
"No, no, no. The boy won't die. The boy will live and grow old, live and grow old, live and grow very old."
He gripped the door handle, and the electronic lock disengaged with a soft thunk. With the memory of airplane sounds crawling every inch of his skin and squirming through his bones, Cornell didn't return to the library so much as arrive there in a crash landing. violently shaking his head and flailing his arms to cast off the offending noise. Staggering forward on wobbly legs, he dropped to his knees as the jubilant dogs raced past him to greet their young master. The boy had awakened and gotten up. He stood maybe 8 feet away, holding a glass of chocolate milk, regarding Cornell with what looked like fear, but might have been concern, because he said,
"Are you all right? Can I do something? Are you okay?"
Gasping for breath, Cornell said, "Dogs! The dogs! Me and the dogs, we were playing. They peed and pooped and then wanted to play, and we were running around under the airplane, running and running, and they wore me out." This was a lie, but it wasn't a terrible, mortal lie, just a little fib so that the boy wouldn't be afraid for Cornell or for himself.
"Do you want some chocolate milk?" the boy asked.
"Not right now." Cornell stretched out on his back. "I'm just going to lie here and calm down, calm down, calm down."
"I already got a muffin and took it to my chair, but I can get it and sit here with you."
"No, no." Cornell pretended to be breathing harder than he really needed to, because gasping helped hide the fact he shook with fear. "I just want to lie here, on the cool floor, like it's a pool of water. Pool. Pool of water. Float here, on the floor, and close my eyes and get my breath. My breath. Get my breath."
"Okay, then," the boy said, and he went to his chair.
The dogs came sniffing around, and Cornell feared they would touch him with their noses, but they didn't. And then they went away to be with Travis. The hateful, unwanted, terrifying thought came to Cornell again. "The boy is going to die because of me." Chapter 3. Having traveled 92 miles from Houston, Egon Gottfried in his Rhino GX, followed by the competent, if methamphetamine-popping, Rupert Baldwin and the impossible Vince Penn in their bespoke Jeep Wrangler, arrives at the bus station in Beaumont, Texas, shortly before 7 a.m. They haven't been able to view the video of Ansel and Claire in advance of their arrival, according to the unknown playwright, who evidently thinks it makes for good drama to keep putting obstacles in their way. The NSA archives the traffic cam and public facility video from all major cities, but not yet from every city and town with a population lower than 150,000, though they're working on it. The population of Beaumont is approximately 120,000, so if the locals want to be part of the great Orwellian future, they better get busy having babies. Waiting for Gottfried and his men is an FBI agent named Leon Fettweiler, who is as memorable as a dish of vanilla ice cream. To the best of Gottfried's knowledge, Fettweiler is not an Arcadian, but he was in the area and dispatched to view the bus terminal video. With Fettweiler is the bus station manager, so nondescript that she makes Fettweiler look flamboyant. Gottfried doesn't even bother to listen to her name, for it's obvious that this woman is a walk-on and will not reappear, less a real character than a thin concept. The video can be viewed on a monitor in the nameless manager's office. The terminal's video recorder is old and oddly configured, so the disk that contains the images preserves them only for 7 days, cannot be tapped to transfer its data to another device, and can be viewed only here. Enduring the manager's convoluted explanation for this inconvenience is as boring as listening to someone read aloud from a health insurance policy. When the video finally runs, a 4-second snippet from 5:05 p.m. the previous day, it's the quality of a 1950s porno film shot with an 8mm camera in a motel room using only available lamplight. Gottfried, Rupert, and Vince crowd together to watch a woman of Claire's height and build step out of a bus. She wears a headscarf. Following her is a Stetson-wearing man of Ansel's height and build.
"Who are they, anyway?"
the station manager asks. Viewing the brief video again, Gottfried says, "Criminals."
"What have they done?"
"Committed crimes."
"We're not at liberty to say,"
Fettweiler tells the station manager, as if Gottfried hasn't made that clear. Video from a different camera shows the same man and woman meeting an Uber driver in front of the terminal. Since they are leaving the station, the camera catches them mostly from the back.
Is it them? Godfrey asks Rupert Baldwin.
Fingering his bolo tie, shifting his weight back and forth from one of his hush puppies to the other, Rupert squints at a third and fourth playing of the first video segment.
Damn if I know.
Vince speaks up.
Me neither. They might be, they might not. It's hard to say. The video isn't good, the lighting isn't. Oh, it's them. Sure enough, says Fettweiler,
mercifully putting an end to Vince Penn's analysis.
The Uber driver will confirm without hesitation.
Where is he? Godfrey asks.
He wouldn't come in here. Insists we meet him out in the parking lot.
The Uber guy is waiting beside his car, a white GMC Terrain SLE. The unknown playwright has found the energy to paint this character with somewhat more detail than the station manager and Fettweiler. His name is Tucker Tredmont. He's maybe 30, stands about 5'6", weighs maybe 240 pounds. He is wearing pointy-toed boots, baggy jeans, and a pale blue polo shirt that shapes itself to his unfortunately large man breasts. His brown hair is slicked back, his round face appears so smooth as to be beardless, and his greenish-gray eyes assess Godfrey with the calculation of a card mechanic sizing up a mark. Fettweiler produces 8x10 photos of Ansel and Claire from a manila envelope. Tucker Tredmont says,
Yeah, that's the dude and his squeeze. They booked the ride an hour earlier and I got the call.
Where did you take them? Godfrey asks.
What works best for me is I'd drive you there and show you.
We have vehicles of our own.
I could be working now. I'm not some stinking millionaire.
We haven't booked you through Uber.
I also drive my own time. Uber don't own my ass.
This back and forth continues for a half minute before Godfrey warns Tredmont that he's obstructing justice, when what he wants to do instead is use his collapsible baton to reshape the guy's head. The charge of obstruction is of no concern to the driver, and after yet a few more exchanges, Godfrey decides that it doesn't matter if he breaks the rules and pays. The guy isn't real anyway, and neither is the money. Only Godfrey is real, and this is just the playwright trying to make him crazy. So get on with it.
How much if you drive and we follow?
Tredmont says,
$121.50.
You're not serious.
The place I took them, it's not just around the corner.
Determined not to round it up with a tip, Godfrey takes 6 20s from his wallet, but he has no $1 bills. Rupert provides $1 and Vince has 2 quarters.
We're fine from here, Godfrey tells Fettweiler. Thanks for all your help.
I was planning to stay with you on this next part.
Unnecessary. We've got it.
Fettweiler is gone, as if he never existed. In his Rhino GX, with Rupert and Vince and the Jeep Wrangler behind him, Godfrey follows the GMC Terrain out of the parking lot. They haven't gone a block when his smartphone rings. The call is from the leader of his cell, Judge Sheila Draper Cruxton. The conversation that Godfrey had with her the previous night, during his cab ride to the Hyatt Regency in Houston, was so pleasant that he looks forward to speaking with her again, until she starts to chew him out for the screw-up at the Longren place. Janice Dern clearly had psychological problems. Godfrey should have recognized her instability. He never should have included her in the operation. In fact, considering that she represented a grave potential risk to the revolution, he should have taken her someplace quiet and put a bullet in her head long before this. Yada, yada, yada. The judge assures him that his failure in this matter will have consequences and warns him not to fail to capture Ansel and Claire Hawk, because if he doesn't get his hands on them pronto, the consequences will be serious indeed.
Were you shtupping the bitch? She asks.
What bitch?
The judge is incensed.
What bitch are we talking about? Janice! Is that why you couldn't see she had a screw loose? Because you were so busy putting new screws to her?
No, sir. No, ma'am. Judge, I'm not like that.
You better stop wasting your testosterone, Godfrey. Keep your pants zipped, man up, start breaking heads, and get the job done.
Judge Sheila Draper Cruxton terminates the call. Following Tucker Tredmont to whatever unpleasant surprise will come next, Egon Godfrey sourly wonders what the unknown playwright intends by layering on all these frustrations, what Godfrey is meant to intuit about the direction his role should take. He has so badly wanted to bludgeon so many people recently, not least of all Vince Penn and Tucker Tredmont. Judge Draper Cruxton's tirade suggests that in this regard, if in no other, Godfrey intuits what the playwright wants of him. Maybe it's time to be ruthless. If someone frustrates him, maybe he should answer them with violence. The previous night, he dreamed of shooting Ansel Hawk and slitting Claire's throat. Now that he thinks about it, the unknown playwright has spoken to him in dreams before, when Godfrey has been floundering in his role. And thereafter, everything was all right again. Chapter 4. Palm Springs to Rancho Mirage, through Indian Wells, past La Quinta. Jane Hawk in a world of sand traps and water hazards. More than 100 world-class golf courses in the 6 up-valley towns, but with no time for leisure, living now for one purpose, with one task at which she must not fail. Indio was less about leisure, a center of industry and farm servicing companies. Much of it looked dusty, weathered, and weary here on the edge of the San Andreas Fault. Ferrante Escobar, nephew of Enrique de Soto, operated his legit business, customizing limousines, high-end SUVs, and other vehicles for wealthy clients out of a 4-acre fenced and gated property in an industrial area. The manned guardhouse and the tight security had less to do with the value of the vehicle inventory than with the illegal weapons business conducted from a secret basement under one of the 3 large concrete block and corrugated metal buildings in which vehicles were being rebuilt. The workers started at 7 o'clock. Jane arrived shortly thereafter, in the pixie-cut chestnut-brown wig and the stage-prop glasses with black frames, her blue eyes made brown by contact lenses. She told the guard, "Eleanor Dashwood to see Mr. Escobar," and presented a California driver's license. The guard directed her to the 3rd building. By the time she parked the Explorer, Ferrante had come out to greet her. Slim, good-looking, well-barbered, he had the lithe movements and erect posture of a matador. He stood where the shadow of the building and the morning sun together scribed a territorial boundary on the pavement. His soft, musical voice matched his smile. "I'm so pleased to meet you. So very pleased." He had a boyish quality, a fresh, scrubbed, wide-eyed innocence that didn't comport with his second career as an arms dealer. South of 30, he was young to have created such a successful business, but of course his Uncle Ricky had floated him the startup money. He knew who she really was. There were no secrets between him and Enrique. Jane said, "I appreciate the risk you're taking by letting me put this thing together here. I'm grateful." He nodded. There was something shy about the nod, a kind of deference in the way he stood, a coyness in his stare that seemed simultaneously to engage her and retreat from her. His handshake was firm, but when she met his eyes, he looked away. "The vehicles from my uncle will be here by 11. Meanwhile, we have a comfortable client lounge. Coffee, donuts, TV. Ricky told you I'm also in need of a handgun?" She preferred to have 2 at all times. She'd disposed of the gun she had used to defend herself in Tahoe on Sunday, because it could be tied to the death of a major Arcadian. "A Heckler & Koch compact 45? "Yes. Yes, of course. Do you want to arrange that now?" "Best get it out of the way. I'll have a lot to do later." "Then please, follow me." She got her tote from the car. It now contained the package of $120,000 for Enrique de Soto and $90,000 additional. Ferrante led her out of sunlight into shadow. As they stepped into a hallway, he said, This building is devoted to the storage of vehicle parts, supplies, and my office. Ferrante's sanctum was perhaps 30 feet square, with a 14-foot ceiling. The frosted glass windows were 10 feet off the floor, as if to ensure privacy even from drones. When he closed the door, an electronic lock shot home a deadbolt with a loud clack. Jane saw two other doors, perhaps one to a bathroom and the other an exit directly to the outside. The room featured sleek modern furniture, teak, steel, glass, black leather upholstery, all spotless, gleaming. Everything was of the same style except for an unusual bristling sculpture on his desk, presented on an acrylic plinth, and four disturbing 4-foot square paintings that formed a giant art block on one wall. Each painting depicted a human heart in realistic detail, the glistening muscles so lovingly rendered that Jane could almost see it contract and expand. Blood dripped from 3 hearts, squirted in a rich stream from the 4th. Each organ was festooned with different severed veins and arteries, aorta, superior vena cava, descending aorta, pulmonary artery, inferior vena cava. Every heart was bound and cruelly pierced by a woven cincture of thorny brambles. Enrique said his nephew was devout. These images were the Sacred Heart of Christ, but not as usually portrayed. The over-the-top details and lavish gore seemed to mock the subject, though if Ferrante was truly devout, mockery was out of the question.
"What do you think of the artist's work?" Ferrante asked.
She said, "Striking."
"Yes, exactly."
"Bold."
"Some people don't get it."
"Colorful," she said.
"If they don't get it, I never preach at them."
"That's wise." Shyly, as before, he looked at her sideways, nodded, and then turned his attention to the paintings.
"Every time I look at them, I'm deeply moved, inspired, justified."
The last word in the series was peculiar, and therefore the most significant. Jane couldn't imagine any other meaning than that, to his way of thinking, his devotion justified or excused his criminal activity. His Uncle Ricky wasn't the only relative who operated on the wrong side of the law. The kid was born into a crime family of sorts, so maybe he felt compelled to uphold the tradition. As she watched Ferrante smiling and nodding and gazing at the gruesome hearts, another possibility occurred to her. Ricky claimed his nephew attended Mass every day and says his rosary like some old abuela who wears a mantilla even in the shower. If Ferrante thought that being devout was adequate penance that allowed him to profit from the illegal sale of weapons, he might believe it also justified worse crimes, like rape and murder. That thought wasn't evidence of rampant paranoia. It was merely a consequence of her experience. In her time at the Bureau, Jane had captured a serial killer, J.J. Crutchfield, who insisted that he was doing the Lord's work, killing oversexed teenage girls who would corrupt teenage boys if he didn't stop them. Thus, he was saving both the boys and the girls from damnation. He preserved his victims' eyes in jars, convinced, or so he claimed, that in each girl's moment of death, she'd seen God. To J.J., the eyes were sacred relics. He found it difficult, however, to explain why God wanted him to rape the women before killing them to save their souls. While Jane pretended to admire the paintings, she was aware of her host watching her more directly than he seemed able to do when she was facing him. As a last word on the art, she said, "Unforgettable." When she turned to him, his smile was of a peculiar character that disturbed her, although she couldn't define the quality of it that she found unsettling. She remembered what Enrique de Soto had told her on the phone the previous day, "But I have to say he's a weird duck. Got this blood obsession." He seemed about to speak, but then broke eye contact again. He went around the desk, opened a drawer, and withdrew a Heckler & Koch Compact 45, still in its original sealed box. New weapon, no history, no waiting period, no background check, no formal or de facto registration. The guns Ferrante sold probably came from his uncle Ricky, which meant they were stolen and provided a terrific profit margin. "How much?" Jane asked. He met her eyes directly, and for the first time did not quickly look away.
"I won't accept money from you. There's something else I want. Something better than money."
She put down the tote to have both hands free. Chapter 5. Carter Jurgen finds the place abhorrent on first sight. In the passenger seat of the Velociraptor, he shivers with cold disgust. Rooney Corrigan, Poobah of Sandsucker Society, maintains a small carbon footprint by generating his own electricity. The most prominent structures on his property are 2 60- or 70-foot-tall windmills. They aren't the picturesque stone windmills with huge cloth sails seen in Holland, but ugly steel constructs, tripods reminiscent of the Martian death machines in the War of the Worlds. The single-story green stucco house, where the crocodile incident has occurred, whatever that might be, boasts a roof entirely of solar panels and stands on several acres of pale and sandy dirt, lacking even stones and cactus landscaping. The only evidence that the planet produces flora is 3 struggling king palms with more brown than green fronds, and a misshapen olive tree lifeless for so long that its bleached leafless limbs and weather-shredded bark might be an avant-garde sculpture wired together from the bones and brittle hair of dead men. The long, unpaved driveway is defined only by parallel lines of stones arranged to mark its borders. Parked near the house are 2 black Jeep Cherokees. As Dubose breaks to a stop, 50 yards from those vehicles, and stares at the house with a dour expression, he says,
"I call it a crocodile incident. He called it the possible assertion and triumph of the reptile consciousness. There's like a 1 in 10,000 chance an adjusted person might have a catastrophic psychological collapse after the control mechanism activates."
Jurgen frowns. "I never heard such a thing." "Says who?"
"The genius who invented the nano implants."
"Bertold Schenck is dead."
"I'm not claiming he spoke to me at a seance. He worried about this from day one. He foresaw 2 kinds of psychotic breakdowns."
"How do you know this and I don't?"
"I knew someone who knew the great man. Inga Schenck."
"His wife?"
"Before Schenck, and then for a while after she married him, she and I had this thing going."
Jurgen wants to deny the obvious intended meaning of the words, "this thing."
"But she was a stunner." "Hot," Dubose says. "A lot younger than Schenck, and so hot she was thermonuclear and insatiable. She wore me out."
Carter Jurgen is not naive. He doesn't believe life has some grand meaning. He doesn't believe in good and evil. He doesn't see any issue in black and white, only in innumerable shades of gray. He doesn't believe that life, society, and justice are fair or ever can be. He doesn't believe they should be fair. Fairness is unnatural. It's seen nowhere in nature. He believes in power. Those with the desire and the will to seize power are those best qualified to shape the future. But it is so unfair that a backwoods cretin who surely got into Princeton on a fraudulently obtained scholarship, who at breakfast folds 2 strips of bacon